Welcome to episode 24 of the Fredcast for the week of July the 10th, 2006. My name is David, and I'm a Fred. In today's episode of the Fredcast, the tour continues rolling along and has finished its first week, just 2 weeks to go. More information from the doctor involved in the Operacion Puerto doping scandal. Major tours talking about rejecting the UCI Pro Tour once again. The LA Times does a investigation of Lance Armstrong and doping. And does Floyd Landis need hip surgery? There's much more news beyond that. Plus, features. Bents on the Fredcast talks safety this week. A review of the bicycle ride across Georgia from one of our listeners. New and notable on the net, Jane's appeal, listener Mike on heat exhaustion, is there interference between polar heart rate monitors and video computers, and some upcoming rides, news, notes, and as always, pod-safe cycling music. So sit back, relax, and if you're riding your bike, hammer just a little bit harder, because here comes the Fredcast. So how you doing? I hope you're enjoying your summer. I hope you're enjoying the tour and all of your riding that you're doing. Before we get into the news tonight, I have a special request for you. There is something going on called the Podcasting Awards, and they are soliciting nominations for your favorite podcast. Now, hopefully the Fredcast is one of those, and you'll consider nominating us, but you may have other podcasts that you like, and those podcast producers would also like you to nominate them as well. So I'd like you to go to the show notes right now. And I've put a link in the show notes for the podcastawards.com website where you can go in and you can vote for all your favorite podcasts. What we're doing right now is we're in the nomination stage, and this only lasts through July the 15th, so you only have a few days to go. I'd really appreciate it if you'd go on there and nominate the Fredcast for a podcast award. The way that this works is they look at the number of nominations a particular show gets in a particular category. They also look at the content of the show, the production quality, and whether or not the content matches the category in which it's been nominated. If so, and if you reach a certain threshold, then you would be eligible for the voting, and only a certain number of the nominees are eligible for voting. The voting goes on for a certain period of time, and then at the upcoming Podcast Expo, they announce the winners. So, if you would, between now and July 15th, please go on to the podcastawards.com website, nominate the Fredcast for a podcast award in the sports category or in the health and fitness category, although I think I'd appreciate it if you just did the sports category. It seems to me that that's where we probably fit the best. Then hopefully, after they've tallied all of the votes and all the nominations, we'll be eligible for the next round. So please do that. Go to the website. Click on the show notes. There's also a link in the blog page of the website. And nominate the Fredcast as well as all of your other favorite podcasts. I know I nominated a lot of my favorite podcasts, and I hope that you'll do the same. I know that all of the producers of your favorite podcasts, as well as myself, we would all appreciate your doing that for us. Thank you so much for doing it, and now on to the news. And, of course, topping the news tonight, just like it does every year at this time of the year, the Tour de France. If you haven't been watching, if you haven't been keeping track, Fredcast is a great way to do that. Of course, we left off last week with stage number 4 with Tom Bonin in the yellow jersey and Daniela Benatti wearing Bonin's green jersey because, of course, you can't wear two jerseys at the same time. And we left the peloton up in the Benelux region of Europe and getting ready to come back into France for the next few days and weeks of racing. So, in stage 4, the riders left Huy, Belgium on a 207-kilometer stage to Saint-Quentin in northern France. Now, as happens in a lot of these stages, the pack quickly separated into two separate sections after a break by Discovery's Egoy Martinez after only 18.5 kilometers. Now, there's a 5-man break involved here, but of course, as frequently happens when these breaks take off, they just simply could not hold on for the entire stage. And by the end, once again, it was up to the sprinters for the finish, and this one was a spectacular sprint finish with Robbie McEwen coming up with his second stage victory in this year's tour. What was interesting also in the end is, remember, the previous race leader, Tor Hushovd, is quite the sprinter. And just coming up to the finish line, his team was positioning him for the win. But his leadout man, a gentleman by the name of Julian Dean from New Zealand, ended up crashing just moments before the finish, and then ended up putting Hushovd in a really awkward position to try to take the win. Sprints are really dangerous business, and it looks like Hushovd has been right in the thick of the danger all week, because remember, he had very, very similar problems in a previous stage. Now, the next day, stage 5 was a 225-kilometer stage, and it went from Beauvais to Cayenne. Cayenne, in case you don't know, is right on the Normandy coast, right where the D-Day battles happened back in June 6th, 1944. And it's a very beautiful part of France, but it is also one that is very poignant if you ever visit. And someplace that I would encourage you to go see. It's a very, very interesting part of France. And so watching the stage was really great as well. Now, of course, once again, this stage number 5, was dominated by a breakaway, this time of two riders. And this break began about 20 kilometers from the start and continued up until just the last few kilometers. Matter of fact, watching OLN, listening to the commentators there, basically wondering whether or not they would actually be able to catch this break. Normally, the peloton does catch up to the break much, much sooner, and for a time, really, really weren't sure whether or not this break was going to have a chance to succeed. Every rider dreams of taking off in that break and getting the chance to actually win the stage. Today's break was led by Samuel Damoulin of the AG2R team. He's a Frenchman, and Bjorn Schroeder of the Milran team. And Bjorn's from Germany. They broke away along with several other riders at the 20-kilometer mark, and finally they left the rest of them behind after 39 kilometers. And from there, the two of them, although again they're on separate teams, they really helped each other throughout the entire stage, including four Category 4 climbs. They were finally caught with under 5 kilometers to go to the finish line, and then of course the teams were battling it out to get their sprinters up there in the lead for the win. And just before the line, this was a great, great finish, because normally what happens is all those sprinters teams are going up in a line and they're pacing each other and trying to get their sprint leader just in the right position for the victory. And everybody in this stage was battling it out on the left-hand side of the road. And when you watched the overhead shots on television, it was really amazing, because Rabobank's Oscar Freire, he's a Spaniard, it was like he put on afterburners and he just came right up the right-hand side of the road, past everybody for the victory. It was really, really amazing and really exciting. And when he crossed the finish line and he won, the guy was so excited. You couldn't help but be happy for him. Second and third place went to Tom Bonin and Inaki Isasi. It was a really, really great stage finish. Okay, stage 6. Robbie McEwen did it again, winning his third stage of this year's Tour de France, edging out Italy's Daniele Benatti. Remember, he and Benatti have been battling for the green jersey, as well as Tom Bonin, who was still wearing that yellow jersey. It was a 189-kilometer stage from Liseo to Vitre. This one, there was a 3-man break that took off after about 74 kilometers, and they weren't caught again until there were 4 kilometers left in the day's racing. By then, it was once again up to the teams to get their sprinters up there for the final surge. Robbie McEwen again wins, and this time he was very, very gracious in crediting his lead-out man, Belgian Geert Stigmans, for putting him in the just the right spot to launch his win in the day's stage. One of the things about the Tour de France, and one of the things that a lot of non-cyclists and a lot of people who don't follow cycling on a regular basis, one of the things that they don't understand is that while it appears that this is an individual sport, because again, there's one person wearing the yellow jersey at the end of the race, one person wearing the green and the polka dot at the end of the race. But one of the things they don't realize is this is very, very much a team sport. So when you see somebody win a sprint, it wasn't something that they did on their own. It was because their team got them to that spot to enable them to then do what they do best, which is sprint those last few hundred meters in order to win the stage. It's the same thing when you get to the Champs-Élysées. That last yellow jersey winner couldn't have done it without the rest of his team pulling him up those hills, bringing him the water bottles and the musettes full of food. Without the teams these individual riders would have a much, much tougher time. So it's always nice when these leading cyclists credit the rest of their team for helping them win a stage or win an entire stage race. Okay, so by this point, we were at the end of stage six. Just a quick recap of where we were. By this point, Tom Bonin from Quickstep, the Belgian, was still wearing the yellow jersey, and it really looked like the top 10 was shaking out with names like Tom Bonin, Robbie McEwen, George Hincapie, Tor Hushovd, Floyd Landis, Vladimir Karpets, Sergei Gonchar. There were a certain number of people in the top 10, some of whom were expected to be in the top 10 for the entire race. So what was interesting was when stage 7 came around. Now, one of the things that I've been doing is I've been blogging on the Fredcast website every day within an hour or so of the end of the stage. I post a little summary of what happened that day and some of the more interesting things that occurred during the stage. And what I wrote at the end of stage 7 was this. Oh, and by the way, one of the other things that I'm doing is in each day's blog post, I'm showing the team jersey of the individual who is leading in the general classification. In other words, the guy who's wearing the yellow jersey. So when you looked at my blog post for stage 7, there was the pink jersey of T-Mobile. And I wrote, if you weren't expecting to see a T-Mobile jersey on this page, then you probably aren't alone. With Jan Ullrich out of the race, it seemed to many commentators like T-Mobile was just along for the ride in this year's tour. Sergei Gonchar and Michael Rogers proved them all wrong today. At the end of the day, T-Mobile riders held 4 of the top 10 spots in the general classification. It was an amazing day. Now, remember, a few moments ago I told you that the Tour de France and stage racing in general is a team sport, but Stage 7 was another individual time trial. Now, as opposed to the prologue, which was a very short, quick race, this was a 52-kilometer individual time trial. No help from your teammates. If you lapped somebody, you could not draft off of them. That's against the rules. If you were passed by somebody, you couldn't draft off the person who passed you. That's against the rules. This is pure mano-a-mano cycling, you against the clock, and we see who wins. This was a day of major surprises throughout the peloton. The time trial blew apart the general classification. There were so many riders off their form, it was amazing. Levi Leipheimer, coming up in 96th place in Stage 7, was absolutely unbelievable. Meanwhile, guys like Sergei Gonchar, Floyd Landis, and Michael Rogers had amazing days, and all of a sudden, they found themselves at the top of the general classification. By the way, parenthetically, about Floyd, you remember in the prologue, Floyd arrived late for his start time because there was a mechanical with his bike, and the difference that late start and his loss of rhythm could have been the difference between victory and second place on that day. What happened in stage 7 was very, very similar in that he started the race, and then because the referees didn't like his position on the handlebars, he had to change the way that his handlebars were configured on his bike. He ended up having a mechanical with those handlebars and had to change his bike in the middle of the race. Now, he was only probably stopped for maybe 10, 15 seconds. But if you consider the fact that he had to slow down, get off the bike, change bikes, his rhythm had been interrupted, the fact that he lost by 1 minute, that mechanical, that changing his bicycle, could once again have been the difference between first and second in stage 7. Now, at the end of the stage, Sergei Gonchar from T-Mobile was in first place. Floyd was in second. Michael Rogers was in third. Patrick Sinkiewicz from T-Mobile was in fourth. So now we had first, third, and fourth. And then Andreas Klöden from T-Mobile was in sixth. Very amazing. Some of the previous top 10 leaders had been moved farther down in the standings. Examples: Paolo Salvadelli from Discovery was now in 13th place. George Hincapie from Discovery, now in 17th place. Tom Bonin, the previous yellow jersey wearer, down in 21st place, Robbie McEwen, 57th. Tor Hushovd, another previous yellow jersey winner in the 2006 Tour, down in 82nd place. In another note, at the end of Stage 7, Bobby Julich from Team CSC ended up having to pull out of the Tour because he crashed in the middle of the stage and got injured. So Stage 7 was really quite an amazing day as the riders were getting ready for what are going to be some of their more difficult stages this week. Okay, following that was Stage 8, 181 kilometers. I'm not even going to try to properly pronounce where it started. Saint-Méen-le-Grand, going down to Lorient on the Brittany coast. It was a beautiful day by the time they finished. The stage was won by Frenchman Sylvain Calzadi. He broke away from the peloton along with five other riders after 47 kilometers in the race. Now, you know when we see these breaks, normally the peloton ends up catching the break. Not today. Calzadi refused to get reeled in and went ahead to solo victory more than 2 minutes ahead of the sprinters. You know, when these breaks occur, in the back of every one of the riders' minds that are in that break is the thought that today is my day to win a stage. It's like buying a lottery ticket and saying, today's my day to win the $1 million. It rarely, rarely happens. And when it does, it is sweet. And it was sweet for Calzadi, a Frenchman, winning this stage the day after a French woman won Wimbledon and the day before the day that the French were hoping to beat Italy in the World Cup. It looked to be an amazing day for the French. Meanwhile, Robbie McEwen was the fourth place finisher in the race, but it was still enough for him to maintain his hold on the green jersey. Now, as far as the race for the yellow jersey, today was a rest day as the riders flew down to Bordeaux, getting ready for tomorrow's 170-kilometer stage from Bordeaux to Dax, just ahead of heading into the Pyrenees and the heavy climbing yet to come. So at the end of Stage 8, and after today's rest day, the general classification, the top 10, is as follows. In first place, Sergei Honchar from T-Mobile. Second is Floyd Landis from Phonak, 1 minute back. Third is Michael Rogers from T-Mobile, 1 minute 8 seconds back. Fourth, Patrick Sinkiewicz from T-Mobile at 1 minute 45 seconds back. Fifth, Marcus Foten from Gerolsteiner at 1 minute 50 seconds back. Andreas Klodin, T-Mobile, 1 minute 50 seconds back. Seventh, Vladimir Karpets from the Iles Baleares team, 1 minute 52 seconds back. Eighth, Cadel Evans from Australia and Davide Monlato, 1 minute 52 seconds back. Ninth place, there's Dave Zabriskie from the United States in the CSC team at 1 minute 53 seconds back. And in 10th place, Denis Menchov from Russia and Rabobank at 2 minutes back. The Tour de France this year is still anybody's race. So far, there's a lot of commentators saying that it may be Floyd Landis's race to lose, but that remains to be seen. Listen a little bit further in the Fredcast. I've got another story on Floyd, which may not necessarily portend so well for Floyd. Meanwhile, on a side note for the Tour de France, next year's Tour de France is going to be starting in London, something that we've talked about on the Fredcast before. In 2008, they're talking that the Tour will probably begin on the west coast of France, possibly in Brest. But in 2009, there are reports now that the organizers of the Tour de France are talking about starting the race in Monaco for the very, very first time. So just an interesting side note. It's always interesting to note that it's called the Tour de France, but look at all the countries we've been to so far this year, countries that we've been to in the years past, but starting in London next year and the possibility of starting in Monaco. It is the Tour de France, but it in some ways really is a regional tour among all of the countries that are around France. And there's controversy once again between the organizers of the Grand Tours, the Tour de France, the Giro d'Italia, and the Vuelta a España. They're arguing again with the UCI. Now, you may know, because we've talked about this several times on the Fredcast, that there has been an ongoing dispute between the UCI and its Pro Tour system and the Grand Tours. And the dispute has to do with the number of teams that are allowed to be in the Pro Tour series, as well as the length or the term of those teams' licenses in the Pro Tour. Now, currently, 20 teams are given four-year licenses to be involved in the Pro Tours. Now, the Grand Tours have said that they would prefer fewer teams and shorter licenses. Specifically, they'd like to see 16 teams and three-year licenses. There have been ongoing discussions between the UCI and the Grand Tours over the last 6, 9, 12 months, specifically on this subject, and it looked like they had reached a compromise. I talked about it several weeks ago, and the compromise was that there would be an 18-team limit with three-year licenses. Now, according to reports that we're reading, especially from Agence France-Presse, it looks like the UCI has now said no, they do not want to go ahead with the 18-team limit. As a result, according to the spokesman for the group, and that would be the organizer of the Tour de France, ASO's president, Patrice Clerc, said that the UCI had sprung a surprise by rejecting the compromise and that they are done talking to the UCI. So that may mean that they're going to go back to some of the things that they were talking about in the spring, about having their own series and inviting their own list of teams to the Tour de France, the Vuelta a España, the Giro d'Italia. So, sorry guys, but it looks like this dispute's going to continue. It sure was nice to have at least a few weeks or months of calm, but the storm is back. We have yet to see how big the storm is going to get and how long it's going to last. And as if controversy between the organizers and the UCI wasn't enough, of course, there's still the controversy surrounding the doping scandal that has become known as Operación Puerto. The doctor who's at the center of the investigation, a gentleman by the name of Eufemiano Fuentes, now says that only about 30% of the athletes he's treated over the years have been cyclists. In addition, he says he's received death threats since this whole thing began to come to light back in May. He was interviewed by a paper in Valencia, Spain, called Las Provincias. He said, quote, "I've treated cyclists, tennis players, athletes, footballers over the last 25 years. It's hard to say how many cyclists, but I would say about 30% of my clients have been cyclists, about 20% tennis players, 20% footballers, and the other 30% belonging to other sports." Now, perhaps most scandalous is that he also said that he's been working with some riders who are still in the Tour. He said, quote, "It's possible that the person who wins the Tour might have had a consultation with me. There are riders there linked to me, but I won't ever say who they are. If all the names came out of the riders who have been linked to me and the ethical code was applied by the Tour organizers, the organizers would be the only ones to reach Paris." Now, isn't that interesting? Isn't that sort of similar to what one of our listeners mentioned in an email last week? The fact that there's a very, very good possibility that the entire peloton is doping in one way or the other? Well, now it looks like that's exactly what Fuentes is saying. Meanwhile, another thing that he said in the interview was the fact that any of his so-called treatments were for the health of the riders, not for doping. Instead, he said, quote, "As a doctor, my main priority is to protect the health of my patients. Doping is of secondary importance. First comes health, and if the anti-doping regulations can be respected, then I respect them. If not, then I don't. The health of a sportsman is far more important than any sporting rule. If I can't stick to the rules, I close my eyes and think only about safeguarding the health of my patients." So it seems pretty clear that what he's saying is, yeah, it's entirely possible that I use treatments which go against the anti-doping regulations, but it didn't matter because it was only to safeguard the health of my cyclists. I don't know. Using things like EPO and auto transfusions, I don't think that that's necessarily for the health of the cyclists. I think he's kidding himself if he really believes it, if he believes it at all. I think instead it's just another excuse by somebody who happened to get caught. And exactly what he's going to end up being charged with, what kind of punishment he's going to get remains to be seen. But it seems pretty clear to me that by some of these statements, he's almost admitting some culpability in what appears to be an ever-widening doping scandal. And we'll see what happens when it hits the other sports. World Cup just ended. How many of those individuals that were in that venue were also involved in this kind of activity? We're just going to have to see as the days and weeks go by. And if that doping scandal wasn't enough, the LA Times decided to find another one. In its July 9th, 2006 Sunday issue, yesterday's paper, there is a front page article entitled "Allegations Trail Armstrong into Another Stage." The article was huge. It took up two full pages on the inside, as well as several columns on the front page of the paper with lots of graphs and color photos. The bottom line of the article was that the Times was somehow able to acquire records and evidence from a private arbitration between Lance and a sponsor in a case where the sponsor had decided, after allegations that Lance was doping in one of the tours that he won, they decided not to pay Lance the $5 million bonus that they had promised him if he had won the tour. Now, this was a private transaction, a private legal transaction that took place between those two parties. And my initial reaction reading the article was, how did the Times get a hold of this? And it appears to me that Lance's people are looking into the exact same thing. Now, the evidence that was presented and the reason why they had this quote-unquote investigation by the LA Times was because they felt that it was significant that people involved in the world of cycling, including Lance's teammates and former teammates, and as well as guys like Greg LeMond, were testifying under oath and saying that they heard Lance talk about doping, or that they heard Lance tell a doctor that he had once used performance-enhancing drugs, although Lance categorically denies each of these claims. The doctor, in the case of the doctor, says that he never heard the conversation. Never even happened, even though Frankie Andreu and his wife both say that it did happen. The only other evidence that was listed in there was the evidence that we've talked about before, where the French magazine got a hold of the results of Lance's tests on his B samples several years after they were taken in the Tour de France, and the possibility that those contained the performance-enhancing drug EPO, even though, as we heard on a recent version of the Fredcast, the UCI's own investigators have said that those B samples were mishandled back in 99 and that there was absolutely no evidence of doping. So this was sort of a weird story. It seemed to me like the writer went out looking to show that Lance was involved in doping. And it was very strange to me, again, how they got a hold of this information from the arbitration. It was very, very sketchy as to how that happened, whether or not it's even kosher, if you will. It was even strange to me because in one part of the article, they were talking about an instant message exchange between Frankie Andreu and another racer. And what was really bizarre was that they even listed the screen names of Frankie Andreu and this other racer, which, I mean, that's almost like posting somebody's, you know, famous racer's telephone number in an article. It really seemed to be, well, I wouldn't go as far as to say a witch hunt, but I would say that in my opinion, it appeared to me that this was an article written by somebody who had an agenda and made sure that the information that he presented in the article fit that agenda, and that was all. So I think really, as much time as I've spent on it now, the bottom line to me was it really seemed like a non-event, a non-story, and I don't think it's going to go much farther than this. As I mentioned earlier in the show, Floyd Landis from the Phonak team and the United States is currently sitting in second place in the general classification of the Tour de France, just 1 minute behind race leader Sergei Gonchar from T-Mobile. It was revealed yesterday in a very surprising and shocking announcement, Floyd Landis is actually facing hip surgery after this year's Tour de France. Floyd crashed in 2003 and ended up having surgery on his right hip. He's since had pins inserted in his hip and several more surgical procedures to try to restore blood flow to the bone. But the problem is that right now his right leg is 2 centimeters shorter than his left leg, and he's riding in a lot of pain. In fact, the Phonak team doctor says that he's offered Floyd pain medication, but he simply won't take it. Instead, Floyd continues to ride through the pain. He says it makes him tougher. But I think that after a very grueling season so far, although a very successful season for Floyd, it's going to be very, very difficult for him as we get closer to the Pyrenees and the really tough mountains in this year's Tour de France, especially because, as the doctor revealed, he does not put as much power into his right crank anymore than he does into his left crank. So, number one, kudos to Floyd for the success that he's had, especially riding with this much pain, and wish him a lot of luck as we get into the more difficult and harder climbs in this year's Tour de France. We'll see how he does. Hopefully this hip won't keep him from being atop the podium when we get to Paris in a couple of weeks. Okay, and if you own a felt mountain bike, this story is for you, so listen very, very carefully. Last week, Felt Bicycles and the Consumer Product Safety Commission in the United States have recalled certain felt mountain bikes, about 700 felt mountain bikes. The problem here is that the steel brake boss can detach from the frame, causing the rider to lose control and fall. Now, so far, they've received 3 reports of the brake boss coming loose, but no actual injuries. This is pretty serious. You don't want this to happen. Now, this recall involves all model year 2005 and 2006 Kinesis-made RXC bikes. The frames on these bikes are made with carbon fiber rear seat stays and are equipped with V-brakes and are not equipped with disc brakes from the factory. Frames affected by this recall were shipped to dealers between October 2004 and April 2006. They were sold at bike stores nationwide from October 2004 through April 2006 for between $1,050 and $5,000. They were manufactured in Taiwan. If you have one of these bikes, do not ride it. Contact Felt or your local dealer to receive a free inspection and repair. If you want more information about this recall, you can call Felt between 8 a.m. and 5 p.m. Pacific Time at 866-433-5887. The number again, 866-433-5887. Or visit their website at feltracing.com. And I've put a link in the show notes to the actual recall on the Consumer Product Safety Commission's website. So do you remember a few weeks ago I talked in the Fredcast about a new law in Oklahoma that made it a finable offense to get too close to a cyclist on the road? This one's even better. In West Valley City, which is Utah's second largest city, the police there are going to be having a sting operation. And what they're going to be doing is they're going to be putting bicycle officers in plain clothes acting as decoys. And they're going to have a couple of spotters and some chase vehicles. And what they're going to be looking for is for motorists who are getting too close to bikes, who are cutting bikes off, doing all of those things that us cyclists are so familiar with and that make us sometimes so scared and angry when we're out there on the road. I think it's great that they're doing this. Hooray for the police. I love the fact that they're protecting cyclists in Utah. I wish they would do this everywhere. I get, you know, cut off by cars all the time, sometimes in front of policemen, and nothing ever happens. So I'm really glad to see that. Now, on the flip side, you West Valley City cyclists, if you're on a bicycle, you should also watch out because they're looking for law-breaking cyclists. Things like, and I know none of you ever do this, right? Riding against traffic, running red lights, not stopping at stop sign, failing to yield the right of way. None of you people do ever do that, right? Now, the most common motorist infraction, according to the article I read, is not giving bicyclists a 3-foot berth when they're passing. And the fines that they're going to be passing out for both cyclists and motorists are going to range from $40 to $160. So hooray for the cops. Congratulations for doing this. All of us cyclists appreciate the fact that you're going to be enforcing the laws out there and protecting those of us on two wheels. Thanks, Way to go. And finally, a bit of news about the Fredcast, if you'll allow me. One of the things that I've noticed from looking at the stats on those of you who download the show using a so-called podcatching client is that many of you are using Apple's iTunes to do it. But did you know that Apple has a show called The Pod Finder, which is a podcast put out by Adam Curry? Some of you know Adam Curry from his days as an MTV VJ. Others of you know him as more recently becoming what's known as the Podfather, or somebody who really spearheaded bringing podcasting into the mainstream. Now, Adam Curry hosts this show called Podfinder, and what Podfinder is a podcast devoted to bringing you podcasts that maybe you've never heard of, that the iTunes staff and Adam Curry find interesting. Well, I'd encourage you to download episode 19 of the Podfinder, because if you do, this is what you're going to hear.
Fredcast is a cycling podcast. You can figure that one out. It's devoted to recreational but also endurance cyclists worldwide. The focus of the Fredcast is to provide high-end recreational and endurance cyclists with a weekly audio program containing news, gear reviews, ride reviews, features, interviews, and this is my favorite, PodSafe cycling music.
Okay, so how cool is that? Just a little pat on the back for me, as well as for yourselves, because one of the ways that iTunes noticed the Fredcast, and one of the ways that Adam Curry noticed the Fredcast, is because it's an up-and-coming podcast, our audience is growing, and I thank you and all of your efforts in telling your friends, voting for us on Podcast Alley, putting comments on Podcast Alley and comments on iTunes. So thank you very much. I was really excited to find out about this. Hopefully you are too, because it means that, hopefully it means that our audience will continue to grow and we're going to be here for a very, very long time. So thanks a lot. Appreciate your help on that. And with that bit of good news, that's it for the news for this show. And as always, at this time of the show, it's time for Rick and his Bents on the Fredcast segment. Rick?
Thanks, David. I was sorry to hear about your accident last week. Going headfirst over the bars is a common crash mode for upright bikes, and it is never pleasant, and of course it can be life-threatening. I'm glad you're okay. Accidents, including those dramatic ones we've seen so far in the Tour de France, have brought me around to the issue of safety. Standard road bikes seem to have been specifically designed to launch humans headfirst over the bars, which is not a good thing. On recumbent cycles, it is generally impossible to crash this way, but that doesn't let Bents off the hook safety-wise, though a few riders may seem to feel that it does. Let me explain, but I'd like to summarize first. I feel that fatal and life-threatening injuries in single-bike crack-ups are almost unheard of on Bents. They simply aren't able to toss you forward at the landscape headfirst. But there are still risks involved in riding any bike. On many Bents, you're already sitting over the bars during normal operation, so being cast over them simply isn't possible. We'll talk more about this in a future segment on underseat steering. Rider placement, seat height, assembly center of gravity all contribute to making recumbents less likely to kill or seriously injure you. But that doesn't mean that the overall accident rate is lower on Bents. In fact, I'll suggest it is significantly higher. The main reason? It is possible on many Bents to put your foot down in the direction of travel while still in flight. On a diamond frame bike, your legs are almost perpendicular to the ground. Even if you were to venture your foot down, an unlikely move, it would probably be pushed back without direct injury to that body part, although a further crash would surely ensue. But on many Bents, you can telescope your leg when the bike begins to fall to one side or the other by the simple action of putting your foot down on that side. Twisted ankles, strained knees, and broken legs can result. Better than a concussion, but still memorable. It's for this reason that I strongly recommend using clipless pedals on most Bents. Other reasons that the accident rate may be higher for Bents? Bent riders tend to be older, with slower reaction times, and in generally less robust condition than young road riders. On a Bent, you can't shift your center of gravity to help avoid a crash the way you can when you're able to stand up on the pedals. I've tried standing up on the pedals when the cranks are directly in front of me, and you just can't do it. Bents generally have smaller front wheels, almost never more than a 5.59 and often a 4.51 or 4.06 millimeter tire. Road obstacles from gravel to potholes are magnified for small rotating surfaces like these. A 700C tire can roll over obstacles that prove too much for a small tire, so you have more accident triggers waiting for you. And again, although visibility overall is better on a bent than a wedgie, the view can be panoramic is one of the selling features. Not just of your front tire, the view directly forward of your path may not be so good. Cranks, fairings, even accessories like bike computers may be in the way of you seeing what is immediately in front of your front wheel. For that matter, what is directly behind you can be difficult to see because when you're reclined, you can't turn around and look back. Mirrors can provide some compensation, but not every rider uses them. Lastly, most bends also have a critical speed below which they are unstable. This number can range as high as 9 miles an hour. Watching wedgie riders treading like unicyclists at a traffic light is amazing for a long wheelbase bent rider. Sometimes it takes a desperate launch just to get up to a safe cruising speed, so slow speed crashes are considerably more likely. On the other hand, bents seem to be more stable at extreme speeds. Reviewers report rock-solid stability on racing models, even when plummeting downhill at upwards of 50 miles per hour. And because many models of bents have extremely low seat heights, crashes at moderate speeds may not amount to much as long as you stay clipped in. As a country song said, it's hard to fall when you're already on the ground. One more note. Because of the general safety reputation that apart from getting hit by a car, bents won't kill you, some riders abandon wearing helmets. This is just nuts. You're still at risk from motorists and other hazards, plus you're a bad example to the neighborhood kids who are all riding upright bikes. So please, whatever kind of bike, trike, or other human-powered vehicle you ride, always wear a helmet. Which David pointed out last week in his section on replacing damaged helmet. And our website of the week, which is not a recumbent site, is www.helmets.org. David?
Thanks, Rick. Just a couple of comments about Rick's segment this week. Number one, when he sent it to me, Rick said he was a little bit concerned that he might upset some people with all his talk about safety and wearing helmets and things like that. And my comment to him was, I just don't think anybody's going to get upset at that. Safety should always be your number one priority. Listen, you all have friends, family, whether you're married or single, whether you have children, it doesn't matter. Everybody wants to see you come home at the end of your ride, and everybody wants to see you come home in one piece. So safety should be everyone's concern, and I can't imagine anybody getting upset about that. Next, about my crash. Thanks, Rick. I appreciate it. Actually, I'm feeling great. I am back on the bike and feeling, right now about 90%. My biggest lingering issue was a little bit of a sore neck, but things are feeling really, really good. I had a couple of long rides this weekend, and everything feels great. A little comment about that. If you do crash, make sure you take the time to recuperate before you get back on your bike because you could end up causing even more problems than the one that the crash created. So, Rick, I appreciate your concern and everybody who sent me emails. I'm just fine. Thanks. Finally, about helmets, something that I didn't mention last week, but something that I definitely should have, is the fact that if you do crash and if you do hit your helmet and it needs to be replaced, before you go out and buy one from your local independent bike dealer, mail order company, wherever you get your helmets, contact the helmet manufacturer because most helmet manufacturers have a replacement program. They don't want you to be riding with a helmet that is potentially damaged and may not protect your head. So instead, as an incentive, they will provide you with a discounted price for a replacement helmet. Some of them require you to send the old one in for testing, for quality assurance, and for R&D. Others will simply take your word for it that you crashed. They'll tell you how pleased they were that you were wearing a helmet and that it protected your head, and then they'll give you a pretty good discount on a new one. So if you've hit your helmet before, and if it's got some dents in it, if it's more than 5 years old, or any of those things we talked about last week, call your helmet manufacturer and see if they have a helmet replacement program because you've got to protect your head. And please remember, safety first at all times when you're on your bike. Thanks again, Rick, for that great episode of Bents on the Fredcast. Look forward to hearing from you again next week. Next up, I have another listener audio comment from a listener named John who participated in BRAG, the bicycle ride across Georgia. And I said, if anybody did it, I wanted to hear their comments. So John, take it away. Let's hear about your experiences with BRAG this year.
My name is John, and I recently finished riding BRAG, the bicycle ride across Georgia. This is a 7-day tour of the state of Georgia that's done every year. This year's BRAG was a northern route, riding from Dalton, Georgia, in the northwest corner of the state, to Augusta in the northeast corner, along the Savannah River and on the South Carolina border. I arrived in Dalton on Saturday and set up camp in a tent outside Dalton High School. Others camped inside the high school on air mattresses, while yet others stayed in local hotels or motels. On Sunday morning, all of the participants loaded their gear onto two waiting semi-trailers for the Bragg organizers to take the bags to Cartersville to use that night. I then began the 74-mile bike ride from Dalton to Cartersville. This route was hilly and had 5 rest stops along the way. Each of the rest stops were supported and maintained by the Special Olympics of Georgia, which had several of their athletes riding the Bragg Tour. From Cartersville, we then rode to Jasper, Georgia. This was about a 48-mile bike ride through some very hilly terrain and some very steep hills. After Jasper, we then rode to Gainesville through yet more hills, including some very steep and long hills, particularly as we approached Gainesville High School, which was the host site for both Tuesday night and Wednesday night. On Wednesday, riders had the option of taking the day off or of riding 40, 60, or 100 miles. Thursday morning, we all got back on our bikes and rode from Gainesville to Commerce, Georgia, where cheerleaders from Commerce High School were waiting to cheer for us as we pulled into the parking lot. On Friday, we rode from Commerce to Washington, Georgia, a ride of about 67 miles. And finally, on Saturday, we rode from Washington to Augusta, ending in a nice long downhill stretch and a flat entry into Augusta, where we rode up onto the Riverwalk and past the Marriott Hotel to a cheering crowd that was waiting to greet all of the riders as they came in. Throughout the ride, the support provided by the Bragg organization was really first class. In each city, there was an organizing committee who scheduled events or entertainment. They provided a shuttle bus each night for riders to go from the school host site, either to area hotels or to restaurants or the town square. Many of the towns set up a concert for that evening. For example, Washington had a fabulous evening of entertainment. They brought in a band from Augusta who played for everyone that evening. Bragg is a very social event. There are people from across the United States who come and ride Bragg every year. I met people who, like myself, are from Florida, people from California, Texas, North Dakota, and from the Northeast. Also, you find people of all ages at Bragg. There were 11-year-olds who were riding children's road bikes. There were younger children riding on the backs of tandems or in trailers. And there were riders who were well into their 60s, 70s, perhaps even older, who were riding all the hills right along with all us young'uns. In addition, you also see every conceivable make and model of bicycle. There were Colnago road bikes. There were very high-end Cannondale road bikes, the 613. There were also recumbent bicycles by Renz and by some of the other recumbent manufacturers. There were tandems and triple tandems, and even some bicycles that you would buy at the local big box retailer, such as a Walmart or a Target, brands such as Roadmaster or Magna, that most listeners to the Fredcast might never even consider riding around the block, much less across the state of Georgia. Overall, I really enjoyed Bragg. I got to meet a lot of people who were first-time riders like myself, and nearly every one of them is planning to return next year as Bragg rides from Columbus, Georgia to Darien, which is the middle route across the state of Georgia and does not project to be nearly as hilly as this year's route. I hope that you will consider riding Bragg or perhaps a state cycling tour in your own state. I know that many other states have these. But Bragg is certainly an excellent ride for somebody who is looking to meet other cyclists, to overcome a challenging route and a long week of cycling, and maybe even get a taste of what professional cyclists see in riding long routes every day.
John, thank you so much for that review. It sounds like a lot of fun. I love sort of the fact that you're really riding through just sort of small town America, and you know the cheerleaders are coming out and they're hiring local bands to play for you in the town square. It just sounds like a great week of cycling. Congratulations to you for doing Bragg, and I hope that next year even more Fredcast listeners will participate with you in Bragg, the bicycle ride across Georgia. Thanks again. Now, speaking of long-distance cycling and of maybe getting a taste for what the professional cyclists do when they're out on the road, I want to thank listener Phil for sending me some links that I've put in the show notes for some tools on Google Earth that allow you to track the Tour de France. So again, we've talked about Google Earth before. It's a really cool program that you can download for free for Mac or Windows that allows you to zoom in on particular parts of the world and maybe do tours around those parts of the world. I've seen flybys of the Grand Canyon, of the Kremlin, of various parts of the world. And somebody has put together a Tour de France Google Earth where you can literally go in and see each of the stages of the Tour de France and fly through it as if you were actually riding the tour. And even better, there's another link that I've put in the show notes to a little tool that you can pull into Google Earth that will allow you to track that day's stage live as it's happening. So if you don't have Google Earth, go ahead and download it and get it for free from Google. Then go ahead and click on the link in the show notes where you can track the Tour de France live as it's happening. So if you're like me, you can't watch TV when you're at work, you don't have OLN, it's a great way to at least track what's going on in the tour as it's happening. So again, thanks to listener Phil for sending that link along. Very, very cool. I'm going to be using that over the next 2 weeks. And if you think the riders in the Tour de France are amazing because they are able to ride for 3 weeks across France, I want to tell you about a woman by the name of Jane. Jane and her appeal were brought to me thanks to listener Kevin in Illinois. Jane is cycling across the United States, and she started from the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco on June 29th, and she's going to be finishing up in New York on August 31st. It's a 4,214-mile journey in 63 days. Now, why is this a big deal? I've talked to you about people, you know, for week after week who are doing various rides across the United States. So what that this woman's doing it? Well, let me explain. Jane has advanced metastatic breast cancer. The disease spread is extensive, and they diagnosed her as being incurable. This diagnosis was on August 31st, 2000, hence the reason for ending the race or for ending the ride on August 31st this year. And originally, her prognosis was that she would only live 6 months. In the last 6 years, Jane has had 4 courses of chemotherapy. She has, in the meantime, participated in, now by the way, she's from Leeds, Britain. She's participated in a full Ironman. As a matter of fact, she's the only person with incurable cancer to compete in a full Ironman. She's completed 2 half Ironmans, the London Marathon 3 times, the New York Marathon, and 3 London triathlons. This is an amazing woman. Now, what is Jane doing? One of Jane's reasons for doing this is because she wants to show that people with a terminal illness can still lead active and fruitful lives, and that death does not necessarily arrive just when you get the prognosis. And this is straight from her website. Jane's doing this to raise awareness as well as to raise money for various charities. I urge you to go onto her website at janesappeal.com, and there is a link in the show notes. Jane, I wish you a lot of luck. I hope that your ride goes smooth. I hope that you have nothing but tailwinds, and I hope that you beat that prognosis not only by the 5.5 years that you already have, but by 50 more years. You keep fighting. You keep cycling and competing. We are all behind you as you complete this ride across the United States. Well, as the summer wears on and begins to get hotter, one of the things that you've got to be careful of is that you stay properly hydrated and that you watch out for things that can happen to you like heat exhaustion. And I got an email from listener Mike, and he sent me some audio comments about some things that happened to him on a recent ride. And I thought that maybe by listening to it, it might give you some tips and some things of what not to do when you're out there riding in the summer heat.
Hi, David. Now that summer has arrived, it's easy for friends like me to overdo it. This weekend, I went on a 75-mile club ride with a 4,400-foot climb. It was going to be hot, and there was no shade. I loaded up a hydration pack with electrolyte water and had plenty to eat. I took a bite of an energy bar every half hour with water, had lunch, and a cool down at the turnaround cafe, refilled the bladder, and took off. I was doing all the right things. I wasn't too happy about the two climbs coming up, but I knew it would be downhill after that. But there were headwinds, and I was drinking more under the 2 p.m. sun. With 10 miles remaining, I was feeling nauseous, had a bit of a headache, and I was feeling very tired. A couple of experienced riders in my club watched over me, but they did not know exactly what I had. I suspected it was heat exhaustion, and I was right. A few miles later, I stopped under a tree, cooled off, and I was able to ride another 5 miles. But I felt tired again, and I ran out of water, so I called for a pickup, even though there was only 2 miles remaining. I was glad I did. I looked up the other symptoms, thirst and profuse sweating, but hey, who doesn't on a ride like this? And increased pulse. I won't forget my heart rate monitor next time. The biggest point is to listen to your body, and don't let the finish line lure you into greater health danger, which in this case would have been heat stroke. Instead, I was able to hop into an air-conditioned car, get a bottle of water from the trunk, and I was able to snack on a fig bar on the way home without feeling nauseous. And I could brag that I rode over 70 miles for the first time in my life. This is Mike in Oakland enjoying the Fredcast when I'm not riding my bike.
Thanks, Mike, and I think your story is probably very instructive for the other listeners out there. I looked up heat exhaustion, and it says heat exhaustion is a milder form of heat-related illness that can develop after several days of exposure to high temperatures, and this is the important part, and inadequate or unbalanced replacement of fluids. Those most prone to heat exhaustion are elderly people, people with high blood pressure, and people working or exercising in a hot environment. Now, the most important thing when it comes to issues like heat exhaustion are to know the warning signs, okay? So if you are somebody who camps out or somebody who does mountain climbing, you learn the warning signs of hypothermia. Now you need to learn the warning signs of heat exhaustion, and they include heavy sweating. Now, of course, we're all sweating when we're out there riding in the hot summer sun, but paleness, muscle cramps, tiredness, weakness, dizziness, headache, nausea or vomiting, and finally fainting. The skin may be cool and moist. Your heart rate is going to be fast and weak, and breathing will be fast and shallow. If it goes untreated, it could progress, as we learned, into heat stroke. And those symptoms are very, very severe. What do you do if you think that you are succumbing to heat exhaustion? Number one, drink cool beverages. Rest, take a cool shower or a bath, get into an air-conditioned environment. Now, one of the things in the story that we just heard from listener Mike was that he kept going. He finally got smart and he stopped and he rested and he called for a pickup. If you feel like you are exhibiting some of these symptoms, stop riding. Get fluids into yourself, get cool. And don't continue to ride after that. Get a pickup. Call a friend. Call a family member. This is a great reason to carry a cell phone with you when you're out there on your rides and get picked up, go home, and get cooled off. But most importantly, remember to stay hydrated as you're riding. It's going to get hotter as the summer goes on. You're going to be drinking more and more A lot of times people will tell me, well, I'm not drinking enough because after I started my ride, my water bottles got warm and it was really gross to be drinking my fluid replacement drink when it was really warm. Well, one of the things you can do as the summer goes on is maybe freeze half of that energy drink that you're drinking the night before so that it becomes a big ice cube for you and it keeps your water bottles cool. But make sure that you're drinking more than you would be if you were riding in the winter. Keep hydrated is the most important thing that you can do. And even in this case of Mike, because he said he was riding in the 2 p.m. sun, he might have been better off getting up really early with the club and doing that ride, say, at 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning before the heat of the day. So learn to recognize the symptoms of heat exhaustion. Stay hydrated. And if you start getting those symptoms, stop riding, get rehydrated, get in an air-conditioned environment, go home and rest and continue to rehydrate. Now, one of the things that we've been talking about in the Fredcast recently, a listener wrote in and asked whether or not I knew of any interference problems between Polar heart rate monitors and the VDO cycle computers that I reviewed recently. And I got an email from listener Scott, as well as an email from the U.S. distributor for VDO, and I'd like to share that with you. Listener Scott says, David, as requested, I'm reporting on my experience with my Polar heart rate monitor and VDO wireless cycle computer. Your request was very timely, as I had begun troubleshooting the issue just last week. I own a standard wristwatch-style Polar heart rate monitor that's probably a notch above entry level. My cycle computer is a VDO C3DS wireless with Cadence that I purchased about a month ago. About once or twice a ride, I would notice that my speed either zeroed out or spiked to unreasonable levels. My Cadence did it once as well until I realized I was coasting. On a 2+ hour ride on Tuesday, this occurred only a couple of times, and I noticed that it tended to occur when I went into the drops. My unscientific approach leads me to believe that this is due to the heart rate monitor receiver now interfering with the VDO signal. This morning, I switched my heart rate monitor to my right wrist. I experienced no issues, even when I rode in the drops. I'll continue to monitor the situation, but based on about 40 minutes of riding before work, getting the heart rate monitor out of the path of the signal seems to do the trick. So very, very interesting. Was finding that there was interference. Switching the heart rate monitor from one arm to the other made that interference go away. Now, before I go on with what the VDO distributor had to say, I want you to know that I received emails from others letting me know that this isn't necessarily a VDO problem. It looks like this is a problem that can occur when you're using various wireless devices on your bike, and whether those are cycle computers from VDO or from other manufacturers, it looks like it's a wireless interference issue, and it is not necessarily a VDO issue. But let me tell you what James, who is from Ibex Sports, had to say when he emailed me. He said, they must be using older heart rate monitors that are non-digital. In other words, they're not coded units. The MC 1.0 Plus, which is the computer from VDO that I reviewed recently, presently works on an analog platform. So I can imagine how it could crosstalk with the older Polars mounted on the bike. Although, being perfectly honest, this is the first comment that I have received. Can you find out which Polar models they're using and how they have them mounted? In other words, whether they're using a cycle computer transmitter with the unit or are they just using the heart rate monitor feature? So this is a great time for you to email me and let me know which specific models you're having problems with. I've got the connection to Ibex Sports and see if we can't find a way to get this fixed other than switching arms. Although if that works for you, try it. He says, to be honest, the MC 1.0 Plus has proven to be a very trusty unit, and we really do only get positive feedback. However, we are dedicated to customer service, so please, by all means, give people our web address, which I've put in the show notes, and then they can email us their questions from there. So it's nice always to see a manufacturer or distributor who is being responsive to customer comments, whether positive or negative. So if you're having a problem, please go to the Ibex Sports website, let them know about any issues that you're having, and let me know as well, because I want to follow up on this so that all of the Fredcast listeners can benefit from what we've learned. But if it simply is as our listener has said, a matter of getting that receiver out of the line of sight between the transmitter and receiver on the cycle computer, then that may just be your quickest fix. So check it out. Let me know what you find out. I hope that you found that helpful. Okay, I know it's been a long show, but I do have a couple of rides that are coming up that I want to talk to you about. And the first one comes from listener Noreen. You've heard her name before. She is with Team Rubicon up in Oregon, and they participate in the Livestrong ride every year up there. And she writes and tells me that each year the Lance Armstrong Foundation awards one entry into the Livestrong ride to an individual or team who raise a set amount of funds. Now, this includes her team, Team Robicon, and each year they give away their spot, and this year they're doing it again. So if you're a cancer survivor or would like to nominate someone who has been affected by cancer in some way, Noreen wants you to send his or her story. The winner is going to be announced on Monday, July 24th via their website, and they'll contact the individual directly. So please include contact information for that individual. So Noreen wants you to email your stories or nominations and let them know how cancer has changed your life or the life of the person that you're nominating. This is open to anyone. So if you know someone who would benefit greatly from this, please, by all means, send him or her the email address that I've listed in the show notes. The winner must be able to have transportation to Portland on July 30th, which is the big day of the ride. So if you're out of the state and you don't know whether or not you're going to be able to get there, don't nominate yourself or somebody else because you don't want them to get it and then not be able to get themselves to Portland. Noreen sent along the last three recipients. In 2003, it was Kelsey Reese. 2004, Greg Talbert. And in 2005, Ethan Euphrosio, who's 4 years old. So this is a really, really great thing that Team Rubicon does. Please go to the show notes and click on the link for the email for Team Rubicon. And I've also put a link in the show notes so where you can learn about past representatives who have gotten Team Rubicon's spot in the Livestrong ride. This is a very, very nice, very sweet thing that they're doing. And if you know somebody, please nominate them. I think it would be a great opportunity for them to participate in a really special event. Okay, well, we heard the report earlier about a great multi-day event, which is a bicycle ride across Georgia. And timed to coincide with the bicycle ride across Georgia, USA Today, which is a newspaper that I've talked about a lot here on the Fredcast and really complimented them for their cycling coverage, USA Today had an article on June the 29th about Bragg and about other multi-day events that are coming up. So I thought that I would provide a link in the show notes to the article, and it's there. And I'd also tell you about some of the other multi-day events that they covered that they thought were noteworthy, and which to me all sound like great events. The first one that's coming up, and it's coming up very, very quickly now, is Cycle Across Maryland. This takes place July the 13th through the 16th. There's various routes from 17 to 100 miles. All of them are originating in Princess Anne. The next one coming up after that is Bicycle Ride Across Tennessee. This is September 16th through the 22nd. It's 350 miles in the western end of the state from Natchez Trace State Park to Mousetail Landing State Park. Around the same time, the Legacy Annual Great Bicycle Ride Across Utah, September 17th through the 23rd, 400 miles from Blanding to Cedar City. After that, the Great Arizona Bicycle Adventure, September 29th through October 7th, 680 miles from Tucson on the east rim of the Grand Canyon to Tucson. And then finally, concurrently with that, Cycle North Carolina, September 30th through October 7th, 447 miles from Banner Elk in the mountains to Emerald Isle on the coast. There's a link in the show notes to the article, and the article has links to all of these rides. Multi-day rides sound like a great time. I hope that you'll be able to take the time to participate in one of these events. Next up, very, very quickly, two centuries that are coming up that I want to tell you about, two that are very, very popular, very, very well known, and which fill up very quickly. First one is the Hotter Than Hell 100. I've put a link in the show notes to that one. That is a very popular event, but it really is very, very hot down there in Texas for that one. And then, of course, in November, one that is very, very popular out here in the western United States, which is El Tour de Tucson, and that's taking place in November. Links to both of those rides are in the show notes. And then finally, I do want to mention one more time two Tour de France viewing parties, both of which are supporting important charities. The first one is in Irvine, California. That's coming up this Saturday morning, July 15th. They're going to be showing the tour live at a party to benefit the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, and I put a link in the show notes to that one. And then just a few days later, up in San Francisco, July 18th, at 8 o'clock p.m., they're going to be showing the stage that is the Alpe d'Huez, which is always one of the most popular stages in the Tour de France, and this one's to benefit the Breast Cancer Fund. And again, link in the show notes to more information about that. Okay, just a couple of shout-outs before we go tonight. I know we've run a little bit long, but wanted to mention just a couple of shout-outs here. The first one came from listener Damien in Sydney, Australia. And he last week I was talking about how they categorize the climbs in the Tour de France, and I was giving you some very scientific ways that they do it. Well, he has something a little bit more simple that he found on a French website, and he translated it for me as follows. It says, well, it's quite simple. You take a Citroën Model 2 CV. If it climbs the hill in fourth gear, it's a fourth category climb. Same thing with third gear, second gear, and first gear. And if the 2 CV won't climb at all, it's a beyond category climb. So I thought that was kind of funny. I appreciate Damien for sending that in. Next was from listener John in Fort Worth, Texas. He was the one who reminded me that I didn't talk about the helmet replacement programs that a lot of the helmet companies have that I talked about earlier. So thank you very, very much for that. And finally, a shout out to Kristen from the Manic Mommies podcast. Kristen has told me that her husband is a Fredcast listener and an avid cyclist. As a matter of fact, he was on her show recently, and they talked very, very briefly about the fact that he spends time and money on his cycling. And Kristen sent in this audio comment to the Fredcast listener hotline.
Hey, David. This is Kristen from the Manic Mommies podcast. I was just listening to your show about the Tour de France. And as you know, I am married to a Fred named Steve, who is a big Tour de France fan. And, you know, being married to a Fred is makes life a little different for everyone, but especially around the Tour de France. Our son was, in fact, born on July 14th, a couple of years ago, and my husband thought that was fabulous because it meant he could take a week off to hang out with his new son and watch Lance Armstrong in the Tour. He also, over the last couple of years, has made our son wear yellow every day that Lance wore yellow, which started to cause a little concern for some of his daycare providers when my son would arrive every day in the same yellow jersey. Anyway, it's been a little less intense this year now that Lance is out of it, but it is no less still pretty funny to watch my one-year-old daughter wear her Tour de France yellow jersey from when Lance was on the Trek team. On the U.S. Postal Service. Anyway, keep up the good work. I love the show, and I thought your last show where you really explained the Tour de France and all the jerseys was very informative and very helpful. Talk to you later.
Thanks, Kristen. It was great to hear from you. And I have to tell you, I just don't go that overboard in my house when it comes to the Tour de France, not as much as Steve does. I mean, you know, around here, I just make my kids speak French for a month, but no big deal other than that. But seriously, Kristen, thank you so much for the voicemail. And if those of you out there haven't listened to the Manic Mommies podcast, it's at manicmommies.com. It is the podcast for the moms out there that are trying to do it all and trying to do it well. So, Kristen, thanks a lot for the voicemail. And please say hello to Steve and the rest of your family for me. And other than a little housekeeping, that's going to do it for us tonight. I want to thank you all for listening, and thank you for staying subscribed. Thank you for telling your friends, for voting for us at Podcast Alley, which is easy to do now. Just go to thefredcast.com, put your email address into the little script there, and click vote. And also, I hope that you will consider to do what I talked about at the top of the show, which is to nominate us for the podcast awards in the sports category or in the health and fitness category. I would really, really appreciate that. Please, anytime you want to contact us, if you have any questions, you can do so via email to thefredcast@gmail.com. You can send a text message or an audio comment. You can also use our voicemail listener hotline at 206-203-FRED. And if you go to thefredcast.com, I've provided a new link where you can record an audio comment for me using odeo.com. It's free. Just click the link. Use your computer and either a built-in microphone or whatever microphone you've got, and it will email me your audio comment. Makes it very, very, very simple to send an audio comment into the Fredcast. We'd appreciate it. And that's going to do it for tonight, other than our PodSafe cycling music. And tonight, I want to thank my daughter, Megan, for finding this song for me at the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. She found a great summery tune, something that will make you feel cool as the days get warmer. This song is called Longboard Flame Job, and it's by a band called the Del Stars. I've put a link in the show notes to where you can find more information about the Del Stars at the Pod Show website. So that's going to do it for tonight. I know it was a long show, but with all this Tour de France news and so much going on, I just couldn't avoid the length. Thanks for sticking with me. Until next week, enjoy the music that Megan picked out, but most of all, enjoy the ride.